Thanks for joining us. This is Solidarity Journal on WAZU. All the news and views you need from left of center. As always, I'm still Zach, and with me in the studio is Mike Perillo. We are the voices delivering you local, national, and international news. These are your headlines. Scares abound last week for a potential government shutdown. We'll talk about historical reasons for that and the recent outcome of this scare. Ever wonder what it's like to be in the Army? We'll introduce you to Amy, an ICC student. She'll tell us about the benefits and downfalls of enlistment. Resisting taxation for war. War rages on around us in the media. We're left to wonder if there will ever be a solution. Well, some Americans have found one. We'll tell you about their plans. Peoria Disposal Company held an open forum last Thursday, April 7th, and invited members of the community to voice their opinions on a landfill expansion. We'll share with you their voices and fill you in on what you missed if you couldn't attend. International BDS movement forces Israelis to reassess relationship with Palestinians in international news. And as we told you last week, AFSHMI has been hosting nationwide rallies all week, the 4th through the 9th of April. We've got the scoop on how Peoria's We Are One rally went off, in case you missed it. We'll bring you anti-Tea Party thoughts and talks, and as always, we'll touch base on current events and views in labor and more, national topics and international views. This is WAZU, 90.7 FM, Peoria's one and only Pacifica Radio affiliate and a service of Illinois Central College. The history and effects of government shutdowns resulting from the failure of Congress to enact an annual federal budget within the time frame established by law. The U.S. Constitution requires that Congress authorize all budgets of federal funds with the approval of the President of the United States. If Congress fails to pass all of the spending bills, which make up the annual federal budget, and if this causes spending to extend beyond the end of the fiscal year, or if the President fails to sign or vetoes any of the individual spending bills and Congress has no time to address the vetoes, certain non-essential functions of the government may be forced to cease due to a lack of congressional authorized funding. The result is a government shutdown. Since 1981, there have been 5 government shutdowns. 4 of the last 5 government shutdowns went largely unnoticed by anyone but the federal employees it affected. In 1981, President Reagan vetoed a continuing resolution, and 400,000 federal employees were sent home at lunch and told not to come back. A few hours later, President Reagan signed a new version of the continuing resolution, and the workers were back at work the next morning. In 1984, with no approved budget, 500,000 federal workers were sent home. An emergency spending bill has them all back at work the next day. In 1990, with no budget or continuing resolution, the government shuts down during the entire 3-day Columbus Day weekend. Most workers were off anyway, and an emergency spending bill signed by President Bush Sr. over the weekend has them back at work Tuesday morning. 1995 through 1996. 2 government shutdowns beginning on November 14, 1995, slowed or idled different functions of the federal government for various lengths of time until April of 1996. The most serious government shutdown in the nation's history resulted from a budget impasse between Democratic President Clinton and the Republican-controlled Congress over funding for Medicare, education, the environment, and public health, which seemed to be traditional issues of contention and argument between the members of our two-party system. The first of the 2 government shutdowns in 1995 and 1996 lasted only 6 days, from November 14th to November 20th. Following the 6-day shutdown, the Clinton administration released an estimate of what the 6 days of an idled federal government had cost. The 6-day shutdown cost taxpayers about $800 million, including $400 million to furloughed federal employees who were paid but did not report to work, and another $400 million in lost revenue in the 4 days that the IRS Enforcement Division were closed. This also inconveniences citizens. For instance, Medicare. Some 400,000 new eligible Medicare recipients were delayed in applying for the program during this shutdown. Social Security. Claims from 100,000 new Social Security applicants were not processed. 200,000 New or replacement Social Security cards were not issued. 300,000 office visits were denied, and 800,000 toll-free calls for information were not answered. New patients were not accepted into clinical research at the National Institutes of Health. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention stopped disease control and surveillance, and hotline calls concerning diseases were not answered. Toxic waste cleanup work at 609 sites stopped as 2,400 workers were sent home. Delays occurred in the processing of alcohol, tobacco, firearms, and explosives applications by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. Work on more than 350,000 bankruptcy cases reportedly was suspended. Cancellation of the recruitment and testing of federal law enforcement officials reportedly occurred, including the hiring of 400 Border Patrol agents, and delinquent child support cases were delayed. Multiple veterans' services were curtailed, ranging from health and welfare to finance and travel. 80,000 passport applications were delayed. 80,000 visas were delayed. The resulting postponement or cancellation of travel cost the United States tourist industry and airlines millions of dollars. 2 million visitors were turned away from the nation's national parks, resulting in the loss of millions in revenue. FHA mortgage loans worth more than $800 million to more than 10,000 low and moderate income working families were delayed. All of these delays occurred in just 6 days. Based on history, here is how a long-term government shutdown might affect some government-provided public services. Social Security. Benefit checks would probably keep coming, but no new applications would be accepted or processed. Welfare. Again, the checks would probably continue, but new applications for food stamps might not be processed. The mail wouldn't be affected, being that the United States Postal Service supports itself, and deliveries would continue as normal. National Defense. All active duty members of all branches of all armed services would continue duty as usual. More than half of the Defense Department's 860,000-plus civilian employees would also work. Federal courts would remain open. Criminals would still be chased, caught, prosecuted, and thrown in federal prisons, which would still be operating. Food safety inspections would probably continue, but rural development and farm credit and loan programs would probably close down. Air traffic control, TSA security personnel, the Coast Guard, all would remain on the job. Applications for passports and visas might not be processed. Parks and forests will probably remain open, but visitor and interpretive centers will be closed. Non-volunteer rescue and fire control services might be shut down. National monuments and most historic sites will probably be closed. Shutdown has been a buzzword in Washington for months, as tensions continued to rise in Congress over reaching a budgeting agreement for the rest of the fiscal year before the current one expires. Just how long can the federal government continue to stagger along without a budget before hitting a political brick wall and shutting down? The government has been operating under a series of fiscal 2011 continuing resolutions for the past 7 months, the budgetary equivalent of holding things together with bubblegum and baling wire. Unless President Obama, GOP congressional leaders, and top Senate Democrats can cut a deal for the remainder of the year. Most of those forecasting a shutdown blame it on sharp ideological divisions and the unwillingness of freshman conservative House members and Tea Party adherents to compromise on spending cuts. Even if House Speaker John Boehner, Republican from Ohio, and Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican from Kentucky, wanted to compromise with the Democrats, which they don't, the Tea Party won't let them. So the argument goes, budget negotiations are gridlocked, with Republicans demanding as much as $61 billion in domestic program cuts for the remainder of the fiscal year, which ends on September 30th. Along with a raft of policy changes, the White House has offered a little more than $30 billion in spending cuts, which Republicans say is unacceptable. Republicans have the audacity to force a shutdown over a $30 billion difference between the spending plans of Democrats and themselves. Given the lessons of the past, how can they allow such debts to be incurred due to a shutdown? And for what? So they can appear to be governing at lower costs than the Democrats? I, for one, am sorry. I'm sorry, Mr. Republican, Mr. Tea Party. I'm sorry it costs a lot to keep our air clean. I'm sorry it costs so much to maintain a level of health to all peoples across our nation. I'm terribly sorry it's so expensive to push kids through public school systems. I'm so sorry we have standards that we are willing to achieve despite the costs, and when the costs are high, we should come together and afford them for everyone. I'm sorry that Republicans would rather extend tax cuts to the wealthiest companies, corporations, and CEOs, which has put us in a budgetary bind and our revenues don't meet our expenses. Where is community? National community. Better yet, where is nationalism? Pride. A pride that delivers on the promises of a more perfect union. Justice. Domestic tranquility. A common defense. The general welfare. And the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our prosperity. Since when has economic liberty trumped social liberty? Since when has the individual trumped the collective? I suppose these backward thoughts have dominated society for a long time. But look what this mentality has given us. We're considering shutting down schools, healthcare, environmental protection, parks and services, all because our idea of liberty is economic freedom. And that freedom is the ability to play a game on a field with other players and win or lose, and winning is characterized by making more money. Liberty should be characterized as social freedom and economic equality. Governments should function to safeguard social freedom and foster economic equality. Republicans and right-wing voices want to ensure economic liberty, which creates economic inequality and limits social freedom. Lowering government revenues makes balancing a federal budget easy once the government serves no function but to wage wars. But as we all may know, a government shutdown was averted Friday of last week. Both the House and the Senate, through the night, passed short-term spending measures that keep the government running until next Friday. Passage followed a negotiated agreement between the Republican-controlled House of Representatives and the Democratic-run Senate on a long-term spending plan for the rest of the fiscal year. That plan is expected to be voted on next week after the agreement is turned into legal language and works its way through the legislative process. The agreement cuts about $38 billion in spending for the fiscal year that ends on September 30th, a decrease that the parties call the biggest annual spending cut in history. Even so, it is just a fraction compared to the budget deficit, which is expected to run more than $1.6 trillion this year. A shutdown would have idled hundreds of thousands of workers and carry political risks for Obama and his fellow Democrats, as well as opposition Republicans, who would be seen by voters as failing to make compromises. The president expressed regret in some of the cuts to services that millions of Americans rely on, pointing out his compromises made out of ill circumstance.
I'm pleased to announce that the Washington Monument, as well as the entire federal government, will be open for business. And that's because today, Americans of different beliefs came together again. This agreement between Democrats and Republicans, on behalf of all Americans, is on a budget that invests in our future while making the largest annual spending cut in our history. Like any worthwhile compromise, both sides had to make tough decisions and give ground on issues that were important to them. And I certainly did that. Some of the cuts we agreed to will be painful. Programs people rely on will be cut back. Needed infrastructure projects will be delayed. And I would not have made these cuts in better circumstances.
GOP-controlled House and Speaker of the House, Boehner, a Tea Party-supported member of Congress, was at the helm pushing for these cuts.
I'm pleased that Senator Reid and I and the White House have been able to come to an agreement that will, in fact, cut spending and keep our government open. And I expect that the House will vote tonight on a short-term continuing resolution into next week to allow for time for this agreement to be put together in legislative form and brought to the floor of the House and Senate for a vote.
Some reports point out that the GOP held hostage the federal government at this key time of budgetary votes, using their filibuster in the House to push through spending cuts in all areas of government programs: education, healthcare, infrastructure, welfare, unemployment, huge services that the government is responsible to provide to the people, will now go underfunded. This is one win for the GOP and those who share the mentality of small government, individual economic liberty and privatization, and the decrease in taxation. The federal government now has 3 days to pass the fiscal budget for the year ending September 30th. Most likely, The $38 billion in cuts will stand, and Americans will depend less and less on essential services provided to them by their government, which is exactly where the GOP and the far-right Tea Party want it. Welcome to a private America. Goods and services will be rendered to meet the needs of people by private entities, only motivated to provide them for a profit. Goodbye equality, goodbye justice, goodbye freedom. Welcome to corporate slavery, wage slavery, debt slavery, and the freedom to work as hard as the fascists ask us to. No new tax revenues to balance the budget. The GOP's answer is to simply drop essential duties of government. This budget battle rages on. The duality between conservatives and liberals, and the stagnation it causes. Is it just me, or do we need a third or fourth party?
Can't stand the news. It's always the same old song, another corporate scam. Another story of bad gone wrong, another corporate bailout, another piece of the pie. It's the best democracy money can buy. They rig the elections, and only millionaires can play. And you gotta be cynical. You gotta look into the camera and say, I'm serving the public. When you know it's a corporate lie, but it's the best democracy money can buy.
Peoria Disposal Company, open forum, turned out to be an oxymoron. Many members of the audience saw it less open than PDC administrators did. Thursday, April 7th, at the former Ramada Inn on Brandywine, was the setting of a wonderful PowerPoint presentation explaining the plans of Peoria Disposal Company to expand our current landfill. Local environmental groups were in attendance. I spoke to Tracy Fox, a local environmentalist. This is what she had to say.
I'm Tracy Fox. I'm active with a number of local environmental groups, including Global Warming Solutions and Peoria Families Against Toxic Waste. I think that PDC did a masterful job in presenting the advantages of doing things their way and doing it for the long term. The thing is that although I don't dispute many of the facts that they presented, they did not ever look at the case of what would happen if we just didn't do the piggyback. What options would be turned off? What wouldn't be possible? Many of the things like the accumulation of monies into the perpetual care fund, those could all occur if the piggyback was developed under a separate contract dictated by how people wanted to do things in 2050. There's no unique argument for signing on to that now.
PDC must balance regulatory requirements, public opposition, and landfill capacity. The piggyback approach, which constructs a new landfill on top of one that is either closed or scheduled to be closed. Another configuration is to construct the new landfill adjacent to the closed landfill, using the side slope as part of the new landfill. With both methods, the piggyback landfill allows for vertical and/or horizontal expansion at an already approved site. The piggyback landfill's primary advantage is that municipalities can create more landfill space without a rigorous siting process. Also, the expenditure to cap a landfill can be incorporated into the liner system of the piggyback landfill and offset some closure costs. Communities also can avoid hauling expenses for moving to a new, more remote site. PDC and the city county will maintain a perpetual care trust fund, which is used to assure a permanent source of funding to assist in the maintenance of the landfill. This long-term proposal essentially guarantees the filling of the space with garbage in a maximum time of 45 years. Many local groups believe this will force, contractually, the filling of the space, which will hinder recycling programs, and PDC offered no real plan to increase recycling, aside from the reconstructed recycling drop-off facility adjacent to the landfill. Also in attendance was recent City Council-elect Beth Akison. She stood up and spoke on the lack of openness or democracy which she saw in the meeting. The planners of the meeting offered what they called breakout sessions. After an hour and a half of sitting and listening to what was, more than layman terms, a proposal that they apparently are not taking suggestions or comments on, after that, people would have the opportunity to question their logic. In each corner of the room was waiting a station, and one of the four speakers, fielding questions, stood awaiting. This was the breakout session. An alternative to this could have been an actual open forum, which would have birthed discussions in the moment from participants. In despite of that, the public was given a lecture-style delivery. The opportunity to speak or engage with those who had the answers wasn't given until after the presentation. When the breakout session was announced, questions could be delivered at one of the stations of information, maps, charts, and graphs. Questions would have been fielded by the expert in the station's subject matter. Before we broke out, Beth Akison interrupted. This is what she said.
Did you decide to do the breakout sessions rather than just have people ask the questions and field the questions that way?
Yeah.
I'd like to know why it's...
Actually, it was a suggestion from the county. And the reason why we did it this way is it might be a little bit easier where it's not so imposing for someone to come up, you know what I mean, to the mic, ask a question, whatever, where maybe it'd be a little bit more comfortable for people, you know what I mean, to come to one of these different, you know what I mean, stations. Plus, I think that a lot of this is so, there's so much detail. You'll see we've got even more information, more maps, more things that we can answer questions to and kind of really get down into more of the siting application that we're developing, you know, to answer those questions. So, but honestly, it was an idea that they came up with that's been effective, I guess, in other public meetings and stuff, and so we did that.
Well, the only reason I bring it up is that I had a conversation with the director of transportation for the state of Illinois. And he told me in a conversation several years ago, he said, Beth, be careful about meetings where you do breakout sessions or an open house format, because it's what he called it to be similar to divide and conquer. People are not then given the same information at the same time to process, to generate the questions. And I hadn't thought of it that way, but that was his advice, and he was running the entire transportation system for the state of Illinois, so he's had lots of experience with public meetings.
Well, I can tell you what the Illinois EPA has done. Actually, that's exactly what they've done as far as when they hold a public meeting on issuing a permit application. We actually just got a permit modification approved for a chemical waste unit at a facility we own in Clinton, Illinois. And the Illinois EPA actually had a public meeting where that's exactly what they had. They had breakout sessions where they had agency engineers and geologists staffed to answer questions just like this format.
Her questions gave Chris Coulter the opportunity to mention that this operation of breakout sessions was a standard in meetings held by the Illinois EPA. If you hear Chris Coulter, he says, "You know what I mean," like three times in that delivery. It was strange that he said that repeatedly throughout speaking during the night, as if he might have been condescending toward what he thought was a lack of intelligence in the audience. The feel of the speakers seemed to convey a sort of "we've done it" attitude. The last speaker was cavalier, and attempts at passive humor were on his face and in his talk. As Chris Coulter took the mic after the presentation, and after many people expressed dissatisfaction, and after many people expressed dissatisfaction with the operation, he began to turn the mic on and off as he spoke, saying, "Can you hear me now? Does this thing work?" Seemingly to make us believe that we should just agree to the breakout session and follow their plan, because at this point we'd been sitting for a while and haven't spoken and haven't moved. All the efforts of the speakers were to encourage us to play along. A description of what they were going to do, no discussion or chance to really deliver a thought from one of us in the midst of all of us in attendance, listening, and pressuring an honest discussion from the PDC in response. I followed up with Beth Akison afterwards. This is what she had to say.
I'm Beth Akison. I'm a newly elected city council person. I'll take my seat in May, the first part of May.
Okay, and we're here at the PDC. I guess you'd call this not an open forum, but more of a
I think
a one-way conversation.
Well, no, I think that they felt that this was an information session, and I have to say that they've spent a lot of time and energy, and they've really taken, I think, quite a bit of resources. They've used quite a bit of resources to pull this together. Mm-hmm. It's a very impressive slideshow.
It's a good PowerPoint presentation.
It is. But the question I raised was, in this setting, when you break people out into sessions, then the people who are in the different sessions don't get the benefit of hearing the questions and the answers. So you really don't have an exchange of information free-flowing in a group of people. I mean, it's a much more efficient way of sharing information if everybody can hear the question, everybody gets the same answers, they're hearing the information at the same time.
And they didn't offer that to us today.
Well, shortly. I don't know that that's what they were intending, but I think that they were genuinely interested in answering questions, but the problem with this format is that not everybody hears the answers, and not everybody is thinking, they're not thinking of the same questions. So my preference would be that everybody hears the questions, everybody hears the answers, and then people have an opportunity to ask questions based on answers, mm-hmm. and it gives everyone time to reflect. And I think it's a better strategy.
Why do you think they chose the route they've done?
I can't speak for them.
Sure.
Okay. Well, it's really nice to meet you.
Yes, new city council member.
Beth Akeson.
What do you plan on doing with your time in office? Could you tell me what you're going to do?
What I'm going to do is I'm going to work for transparency in government, and I'm going to work for accountability in government, and I'm going to work towards making Peoria a place that attracts not only business but people, because people are what makes cities go.
All right. Thank you, Beth.
You're welcome.
We'll see just how environmentally minded this new city council member will be as she takes office in May. Please, local listeners, inform yourselves. A thick fog of haze rests over this topic. Find a way to shed some light on it and stay informed on the plans of others, which have the potential to affect your quality of life.
It's just about knowing where everyone stands. All of a sudden, people start talking about guns, talking like they're going to war.
At ICC, we have such a diverse character to our student body. I recently spoke to one student, Amy Bill, a 23-year-old English major and an enlisted soldier in the United States Army. I spoke to her about the benefits and drawbacks to enlisted life.
My name is Amy Bill. I am a specialist in the Army National Guard. I have been a specialist for a little over a year. I've been in the National Guard for, it was 5 years in January. There's been some good times and some bad times in the Army. Ultimately, I'm really happy with the decision that I made to join. It's really been very beneficial for me in my life. I'm going to ICC with my tuition fully paid, and that's, you know, because I'm in the Army. I haven't paid any tuition since I started coming to school here. And since I have the GI Kicker bill, I also get a stipend every month, which is pretty much just money in my pocket, you know. My bills aren't, or my books aren't paid, which would be one nice thing, but I really can't complain. That's pretty much the only thing I have to pay for school.
What have you done with your ICC career that's been given to you so freely?
Well, I'm still working on my associates, and I'm not really doing a job that's related to what I want to do right now. I'm just working in like a little coffee shop. But I should be graduating at the end of the summer from ICC, and I plan to go on to hopefully another state school, and then my tuition will be paid there as well if it's a state school.
Oh, that's really cool.
In whatever, wherever I end up being, so.
So, you mentioned you were in the Reader's Theater at ICC.
Yes. I was in Reader's Theater this past semester. It was so much fun. it's actually not a theater class. It's a communications class. So, if you need more communication credits, it counts as that. I took it just as an elective because I have a whole bunch of electives I need to get done. but it was so much fun.
Any high points you could highlight from it?
Oh, the whole thing, really. but...
It was at the PAC, right?
Yeah, our final performance was here at the Performing Arts Center. But we did 9 shows in 4 days. We went all over the place here around Central Illinois to grade schools, high schools. We went to a nursing home, and we did our show twice on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. And then we did it 3 times on Friday, and the 3rd time being our final performance at the PAC here. And we had over 400 people come to see our final performance there. It was and this year was the 40th anniversary of it.
Oh, wow.
What role did you play? So it was a really big deal. Well, the interesting thing about Reader's Theater is that there's not really specific parts, that you don't carry the same part throughout the entire show.
Okay.
It's done more little kind of vignettes within the whole show, and it's just lines. Everyone has different lines, and but you don't really have a certain character that you have to stay
cool
into. So pretty much our only characters were Southern accents.
Oh, I see.
But we covered lots of different things. We recited the entirety of The Midnight Ride of Paul Revere in our thing. We did Ichabod Crane, The Legend of Sleepy Hollow. We talked about Johnny Appleseed, because this year's show was themed all about American folklore.
Oh, I like that.
It was really fun. We talked about Pecos Bill and Paul Bunyan and Calamity Jane and all these different, kind of larger than life legends that we have here in American folklore. So,
and you can appreciate the ability to have that class and that opportunity because of your service to our country in the National Guard and the free college it offers.
Yes. If my school wasn't paid for, I wouldn't. I mean, I'd be in debt for sure, more so than
others.
Normal college kids are.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't be able to afford to take as many classes as I take every semester. I take a full, this semester I'm taking 15 hours.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me too.
So I'm taking a full schedule.
So what have you done with the Army?
Thankfully I've never had to deploy in the 5 years I've been in. Although I was supposed to deploy with my first unit, and that's why I didn't go to college right after I got out of high school, was because I was supposed to deploy. And so I took about a year and a half off and just worked.
How did you not deploy if you were supposed to? What happened?
They basically told me that they didn't need my job to go. My job isn't... I'm a chemical operations specialist. That's what my job is in the Army. And that has to do with decontamination and stuff like that. That thankfully isn't high priority right now because we're not really getting that kind of warfare right now.
Chemical warfare and things.
So thankfully, it's not something we really have to deal with in the Army right now. And so since there actually is a limited number of people they can take on a deployment, and so they opted to take some more. Flight crew personnel and helicopter repair personnel, mm-hmm. rather than to take someone like me who probably wouldn't be doing my job over there anyway. But I have been in 2 different units that have deployed, and so I've been rear support for those units, and then you take care of all kinds of things we ever have to notify family of anything that's going on, or pretty much just being there doing some of the behind the scenes at home stuff that the units need done while they're overseas that they can't do there.
I see. What are the units? What are their functions while they're overseas, if you can mention that?
Well, the first unit I was in when I first joined was an aviation unit out of Decatur, and they took care of all the Black Hawk helicopters in the state of Illinois. And while I was home, and they were overseas, I took care of a lot of, ordering of equipment and, different stuff that they needed that was going to be shipped to them to repair their helicopters. And I ended up being in charge of a lot of that kind of supply stuff, even though that wasn't really my job. And then the other unit, the unit that I'm in now that I transferred to after that unit, is a medic unit out of Springfield. And when I first transferred there, they were just leaving for their deployment. And so the entire like first year that I was there, they were all overseas and I was there at home. And I've learned a lot of medical, like, I wouldn't say procedures, but small kind of things. I know how to like give IVs and draw blood, and I know how to cure like gunshot wounds, hypertension, pneumothorax, which is a chest wound.
So are you studying medical stuff at ICC?
No, I am not doing anything to do with anything medical. I'm actually an English major.
Awesome.
I plan to go into publishing, so nothing to do with anything medical. Wow. But I've learned a lot just being in that unit, which is really interesting.
And you recently got married, yeah?
Yes, I got married February 19th of this year.
Really cool.
Really exciting.
Your husband's in the Army now?
Mm-hmm. My husband is going active duty as an officer in the Army. He's actually in basic training right now. Then he'll be going on to his job school. And so then I'll actually get to go and be wherever he is. So won't be till about August that I'll get to live with him again. So.
And how does that work? The Army facilitates couples and jobs?
Yes, it's a little bit difficult as far as me being in the National Guard still. I'm supposed to be out in about 9 months, but while I'm still in, I'm still supposed to go and serve every weekend. And so if, say, in August, I move to be with my husband wherever he's at.
And that would be stationed on a base, right?
Probably on a base. They would either do an interstate transfer for me, and so then I would just serve in whatever state we were in instead, or else they would do something like a conditional release and just release me early.
All these different conditions and options that they have for you guys, is that easy for you as an enlister to understand?
It's much easier than, like, if I had no idea about any of it. I keep telling people I don't know how regular Army wives do it. Like, if I didn't know what was going on and what he was going through in basic training, it would be driving me nuts right now. Like,
so is there any downfalls to being enlisted? Any downfalls to having that, what is it, one weekend a month?
Yeah, well...
Any stressors or anything that
come
up?
Well, first of all, there's the obligation of it. It doesn't, you know, an example is for my Reader's Theater class, we had double rehearsals a couple of weekends ago, and I had to miss most of them because I already had my weekend obligation to the military that I had to go do. So I had to miss most of that. I mean, you pretty much have to ask them like 6 months or a year in advance if you need to get...
Well, you signed the contract, so I guess you sort of have to plan around it.
Yeah, it's... I mean, and you know at the beginning of the fiscal year what all the dates for that fiscal year are going to be. So it's your responsibility to make sure you don't have to work and make sure you plan things around that.
Sounds like almost nothing can be bad said about the National Guard and service.
I mean, I wouldn't say that there's nothing bad. I mean, there's definitely many more pros than cons, for sure.
What do you think about military's involvement in actions presently in our time now?
To be honest, people in the Army or in any branch of the military, I mean, obviously they don't have a lot of control over it. Like, people like me that aren't, like, you know, way up there in rank. And the attitude of a lot of people in the Army is... We have to do what we're told to do, whether we agree with it or not.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I haven't always necessarily agreed with what our government is doing or decisions that they've made. But since I have this obligation, it's my responsibility to do whatever I'm told to do because I've made this commitment to the Army.
Well... That's really great. I'm glad you like ICC so much and you're excelling in the things and the opportunities that are given to you through your service, the National Guard and the Army. I hope you don't deploy ever.
Hopefully I shouldn't have to. I'm supposed to be out in January of 2012.
Wow.
So if I do deploy, they'll have to stop loss me, in which case I get paid an extra bonus every single month I'm deployed, so you can't complain about that.
Yeah, it sounds like you're really up on the things that they can do to you under the contract. Did that take a lot of study, or is it pretty simple to understand?
It depends. Some things, when you first, like I said, I've been in for over 5 years, so I've learned a lot from people that have been in longer than me, or asking about things.
Great. So when do you plan on graduating from ICC?
Hopefully I'll be done at the end of this summer, depending on if I can finish. This is actually one thing that the Army, my annual training, will fall in the middle of June, and so that might hinder me taking summer classes here. So.
Do you plan on walking or just have an ICC email you the, or not email, but mail you the diploma?
No, I don't plan to walk graduation. I mean...
Yeah. Me either.
I mean, maybe if I go on to graduate from a 4-year school somewhere, I'll do that. But as ICC isn't necessarily the highlight of my college experience.
Yeah.
Although, I mean, I'm grateful for it. I'm definitely glad that it's here for me to take classes here. It's been very, very
highly helpful. Affordable.
Yeah. Oh yeah, and you know, and I think it's a great idea for people to come to a community college before going on to a 4-year school.
Definitely.
People that go to a community college and then transfer in tend to do better
mm-hmm.
once they get to a 4-year school than people that go to 4-year school all the way through.
Well, so. Amy, you're really smart. You carry yourself really well. You dress nice. You look good. You're in the Army. You're going to excel. Hopefully, I'll be able to see you in graduation day. Not walking.
Not walking.
Just saying, woohoo! All right.
I hope so.
So that was Amy. She loves the Army. She's really happy about the quality of life it's given her. But you know, there are a lot of Americans who would much rather not pay taxes for war efforts of our country. And Mike has more on this story.
The numbers speak loudly. Over $1 trillion spent so far on the military invasions and occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan since October 2001. This does not even include the covert operations in Yemen, drone bombings in Pakistan, or the $1.1 million spent on Tomahawk missiles used in Libya, which saw over 112 missiles launched just in the first day alone. Nearly half of each tax dollar goes to the Pentagon and military contractors. Cities and states are closing schools, cutting social services, imposing massive layoffs, and Congress continues to give the president a blank check for his deadly ventures abroad. So far, hundreds of thousands of civilians and soldiers have been killed, millions of people displaced, environmental destruction incomprehensible, all for putting money in the war profiteer sector and a world less stable by the day. Protests and letters to representatives or the president can go easily ignored, but this April 18th, the final day to file taxes this year, many will be responding to the sadistic behavior by our government and protest with their money towards the always increasing military budget that outspends the world combined. Throughout the nation, the National War Tax Resistance Coordination Committee, also called NUTRIC, a coordinating body for war tax resistors of about 6,000 people, in the country who do not pay federal income taxes, will be reminding people how their tax dollars are used. Some NUTRIC members pay a zero amount on their federal income taxes, or pay a symbolic amount, like 50%, to symbolize the amount of our federal dollars that go to the military. They want their money to be used for humanitarian means, and not to oil the war machine. Bill Ramsey, part of the NUTRIC, has been refusing to pay for federal income taxes since the 1970s.
War tax resistors have different attitudes toward federal taxation, but we are protesting the use of taxes by the Pentagon to carry out this policy of perpetual war. You've listed the countries that we're engaged in now, and the list just gets longer and longer as we go along. And as we can see, electing somebody who said he would bring the troops home has not brought the troops home. We're continuing to spend hundreds of billions of dollars that are needed desperately here at home for homes and schools and clinics and those kinds of things that people really need. We're spending that every day about $4 billion every day on these wars that don't seem to have any end. And so what we do is an act of nonviolent civil disobedience in the tradition of Henry David Thoreau and Martin Luther King Jr., believing that we have not only the right to, but the responsibility to make our views known in the strongest way possible, and that we can't live within the contradiction of saying one thing and paying for another.
Federal income taxes that are not paid can then be distributed to agencies of social good, like charitable distributions. Events that are promoted by Nutrick will happen in Wisconsin, Colorado, Iowa, Indiana, Missouri, Kansas, and even Evanston, Illinois. If you are ready to stand against what your government uses your money for, tell them this upcoming week that you will not pay for their illegal wars and mass militarism. For more information about the National War Tax Resistance Coordination Committee and their upcoming events, please visit their website at www.nwtrcc.org.
Bringing it back in locally, the We Are One rallies went off without problems last Thursday. In Peoria, union support was strong as people gathered at the Peoria Courthouse in solidarity with unions across the nation, as AFSCME planned a week of rallies, all of which in Illinois culminated in a blowout rally in Chicago, Saturday, April 9th. I spoke with the president of the West Central Illinois Labor Council. I asked him about socialism and the Tea Party. This is what he had to say.
I don't know how we got from trying to stimulate this economy that was in total free fall to just shutting everything down. It's almost like we're dismantling this country. I don't follow the logic. I think some people see it as a once in a lifetime opportunity for them to just cut government in half, but I don't think they're thinking too much about their children and the standard of living and the condition this country is going to be in if they're successful. We're trying to save them from themselves. I mean, I think an eighth grade class could come to a better conclusion about how you cut and slash and freeze and lay your way off back into prosperity. They do things like this and they stand around and say, well, gosh, where's the consumer confidence? You know, where's the recovery? Where's the recovery we were promised? Well, they shut the funding of it off. They wanted to keep people unemployed and angry for the election, and they were so successful in the midterm, I think they're going to try to starve everybody until 2012. You have your choice in the state of Illinois. Do you want to have a state government that fails to the rights checks that bounce? I mean, we have no alternative. This is the result of procrastination for many, many, many years. That's why we got into this. So we have to choose about this, make a choice about this state, an adult choice, about whether we're going to pay our bills or break private contractors. You know, it's real good to get out there and jump up and down. I'm against taxes. Well, then stay off our roads, stay off our bridges, stay out of our schools, stay out of our libraries. Get real. Grow up. I mean, well, a lot of these people are here to wish our people that are going to Chicago to represent Central Illinois off. This is kind of a pep rally for that big event. We think there's going to be more and more coming. We hope to have a pretty good crowd here in a few minutes. American workers, union or non-union, public or private, teachers, firefighters, everybody ought to take a look at what's going on in this country. And all you got to do, if you don't want to get into it too deep, you just need to look at where the wealth is. You need to see, is it moving into more hands and expanding the standard of living of the masses, or is it benefiting more and more a smaller and smaller group of people? I wonder how many billionaires, if they would just simply be multimillionaires, I wonder how many of the 1 in 4 American children that go to bed hungry at night could be fed. I wonder if we took all this cash that's being hoarded all across this country, purposely hoarded for political reasons, I wonder if we put it on the street, if we could move 17 million at-risk children into a situation where they had a standard of living, where they didn't worry about eating 3 times a day, every day. I really wonder. That's what people ought to be upset about.
His belief that taxation and the planned spending of taxes and responsibility can make a better world, essentially a more perfect union, just as the preamble to the Constitution declares, was quite refreshing. The rally kicked off with a prayer for working men and women. It was a moving time and a great turnout. I hope the folks that made it up to Chicago Saturday can prove to the public and to employers to respect the unified labor force and meet their demands. After all they want is social equity. Mike brings us more on the issue of Israelis and Palestinians with his report on BDS. You might not know what that is, but stay tuned. It's about to begin.
For 60 years now, Palestinians have been subjected to state-sponsored terrorism by the Israeli leadership. With undefined boundaries, segregation laws, discriminate checkpoints, road obstacles, blockades, collective punishment, and many other injustices, Palestinians have been struggling to survive in an apartheid state. They are stateless and denied the right for self-determination, which excludes them to live a normal life. By contrast, all Jews, whether they live in the occupied territories or in Israel, are citizens of the State of Israel. In 1948, indigenous Palestinians in the countryside became victims to widespread violence and made refugees after being displaced from their villages by Israeli forces. Then after the Six-Day War in 1967, Israelis occupied more of the Palestinian land. From then on, the U.S. military, still to this day, continues like clockwork to fund Israel over $3 to $5 billion a year, a lot of which goes towards the arming of Israel's military. Diplomats and supposed peace negotiations have failed. Most critical discussions on the subject go ignored or lambasted as anti-Semitic or as sympathy for Palestinian terrorism. The U.S. constantly vetoes U.N. resolutions that condemn Israel and the illegal occupation. Human rights groups are attacked for showing the violations that Israel has committed that go as far back as the First Intifada from 1987 to 1993. It was not until 2001 at the NGO Forum that it was declared that Israel was practicing apartheid and nonviolent tactics were needed to stop it. One of these tactics came about in 2005, called the BDS movement, also known as boycott, divestment, and sanctions, which forced Israel to face the brutality that they were meting out to the Palestinians. Started by a coalition of Palestinian civil society groups and individuals, their goal was to get the world to consider the BDS merits. The BDS movement just doesn't bring the illegal occupation to surface, but disrupts the status quo by cutting off Israelis' funding of the occupation. The BDS is not anti-Israel, it is anti-occupation, anti-racism, and anti-colonialism. BDS is an integral part of the Palestinian nonviolent tactics. Quite simply, BDS is the globalization of Palestinian nonviolent action against Israel's occupation. Pro-Israel groups like Coalition of Women for Peace and Boycott, and supporting the Palestinian BDS call from within, have reconsidered their position on BDS and have recognized it as a useful tactic. Even Roger Waters from Pink Floyd has been outspoken on what has been happening to the Palestinians and has joined the boycott.
And it's actually me calling upon my fellow musicians and artists to join the BDS campaign against Israel, because I've finally decided to put my head above the parapet. Enough is enough. They pay lip service to the idea that they want to make peace with the Palestinians, and they sort of talk around the possibility of a two-state solution. But in the meantime, they're throwing people out of their homes in the Negev, in East Jerusalem. They're annexing huge parts of the West Bank. So all this talk about is just, they're quietly getting on with taking over the whole of the land. What happens then to the Palestinians?
Boycotts are not a new phenomenon to the repertoire of nonviolent tactics. There is a long history showing its effectiveness, from the California grape workers who boycotted the growers for better working conditions and equal wages, to ending bus segregation in Montgomery, and most notably, the South African apartheid. Boycotts have worked and brought down these immoral forces. Even Howard Kaur, executive director of AIPAC, the Israel lobby in America, feels that if left unchallenged, allowed to go unchecked, it, being BDS, will work. President Obama, adding himself into a long history of other U.S. presidents, has failed in confronting the Netanyahu government over its settlement building and has conformed. Outside pressure is the only answer to stop the death and destruction of the Palestinian people and the perpetual violence that happens to the Israelis and Palestinians. If the international community does not step up and act, future Palestinians and Israelis will live in a world of apartheid regime. For more information on how to get active, please visit the BDS movement website at bdsmovement.net.
Well, you've just been a part of Public Community Radio. Participate and add to our voice. We thank you for tuning in to Solidarity Journal. This is WAZU 90.7 FM, Peoria's one and only Pacifica Radio affiliate. We encourage you to visit our website, wazufm.org. We encourage you to attend ICC. We encourage you to give us your feedback. Write me an email, zachteague@live.com. ZACKTEAGUE. Easy as that. And as always, thanks for listening.
It was real good to get out there and jump up and down. I'm against taxes. Well, then stay off our roads, stay off our bridges, stay out of our schools, stay out of our libraries. Get real. Real life.
That forces folks to crawl. Keep party on the Capitol lawn and Sarah Palin singing along, laughing all the way to the Pentagon. Y'all remember when John McCain and Sarah Palin were talking about stopping the Washington establishment? John McCain is so Washington establishment. Can you believe that crap? In Washington since Philadelphia was the capital, you know? That's crap. I should have told us something. Tea party on the Capitol lawn. Asking you which side you're on. Drawing battle lines in this country. Oh, but there's something about our worldview. Something about the lens we look through. That keeps us from building something new that works out better for more of us. Well, it's in the cracks where the levees broke. It's in the cash Goldman Sachs stole. It's in the fields of tomatoes where the legacy of slavery roams. It's a hatred born of jealous fear. A hatred born and bred right here. Xenophobic and insecure with a deadly outcome. It's a racism that grows and thrives from religions used to justify an endless list of human rights denied in the name of liberty. Tea party on the Capitol lawn, and the Christian terrorists are singing along, getting ready for the race war. Remember those guys in Michigan? They were gonna kill a cop and then blow up the funeral with homemade bombs, and guess what? The media wouldn't call them terrorists because they were white Christians. They weren't brown Muslims. So they weren't terrorists, you know? That's a tea party for you. Now you're telling me immigrants should go back home. I say no, the ground that you're standing on. Cause Arizona was Mexico and your grandparents were European. And your national heroes like Thomas Paine were immigrants when they came and called themselves Americans. And that's how it's always been. The Marine One didn't steal your jobs. They were outsourced by Bill and Ron as South America's wealth was robbed by U.S. corporations. So when they dumped the tea in Boston, it was an attack against the corporation. So I don't see the connection between that story and yours and Christmas addicts and the Boston dead weren't fighting for a white nation. They were fighting occupation like the Iraq and Afghan wars. Tea party on the Capitol lawn, asking you which side you're on. Join the battle.